And it is today's Topical Currents, Monday edition. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Today we visit with author and religion scholar Dr. Thomas Moore. His latest book is A Religion of One's Own, A Guide to Creating a Personal Spirituality in a Secular World. And Thomas Moore joins us from Sonoma, California. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning. Thank you for having me today.
Pleasure to have you with us. So in this increasingly secular world, you say that many of us, in addition to losing our religion, have lost track of our souls. Can you elaborate on that? And what do you mean when you say that?
Oh, I mean so many things. One is that the news tells us all the time that science, like neuroscience and technology, can give us all the answers, really, and can confirm any thoughts that we had before. I think that really is a secular approach. I mean, it's valuable as far as it goes. But, you know, people are going through a lot in their lives today, very deep things going on. And I think they need a deeper point of view. And that's what I mean by soul, is that you get through the surface and get down to what really matters.
Well, hasn't this been going on since the beginning of human beings? And what evidence do you have that we're so-called losing our soul due to secularism?
Well, the evidence is my evidence is, and my experience as a psychotherapist working with people. You know, people today find it pretty hard to maintain their marriages and to find work that is really satisfying to them. And a lot of them, you know, participate either in ordinary established religions, or they're experimenting with new options. And so many don't feel that any of these things really touch the things that matter to them. They still feel somewhat adrift. And, you know, they have symptoms of this. They have symptoms like addiction or a feeling of aimlessness. I see this all the time. And people have asked me, you know, that's why I wrote this book. They've asked me, what can I do? And I wish I could have the old certainty back. So I'm writing about how you can still be inspired and instructed by the religious traditions, all of them around the world. But you can do it in your own way and shape your own religious way of life and your own thinking on these things.
So when you're speaking of creating this religion of one's own, you're speaking to those who are part of an organized religion as well as those who aren't, and even atheists as well?
All the above, yes, that's right. Because I think all of those groups need some deepening. I've talked to a lot of people. I'll give you an example. A person, Jewish person, told me recently that she got a new rabbi who had training and education that was fresh and was able to give her a point of view on her Judaism that she had never had before. And she says, I want to go back now, you know. I was ready to give up on it. So I think, you know, even if you're in a religious tradition, whatever it is, you can deepen your understanding of it and your participation of it so that it really becomes something that is yours, that you can make into your own and not just surrender to somebody else and go through the motions.
Thomas Moore, tell us more about you. You were raised a strict Catholic, and you were a monk for 12 years. And then you turned away from organized religion. Tell us why.
Well, it's hard to say. You know, I was inspired at a very early age, at 13, to enter a Catholic seminary, which was run by a religious order, quasi-monks. And I say that because they didn't just stay in the monastery, but worked out in the world. And then I was inspired to leave it 13 years later. I don't know why. I didn't have a good reason, but I just felt that my life was shifting and changing. I thought I would stay connected to the church, but I realized after a while that, you know, the whole thing didn't have the same meaning for me. But I went on and got a PhD in religion and studied the world's religions and depth psychology, and I've always been interested in the arts. And I put all that together, and I became more interested in religion than ever, so I've devoted myself to it my entire life. So when I write this book, I'm writing as someone who loves religion, loves the religious traditions, and think we need religion of some kind. But I really think that we've missed the boat up to this point. We've allowed ourselves to think of religion in superficial ways as a set of beliefs or practices, and really haven't brought it home. And I don't think that our spiritual leaders have helped us as individuals to find our way as much as tried to give us kind of an off-the-rack approach, you know, for everybody. So I'm trying to emphasize this in this book that echoes Virginia Woolf's idea that, you know, we all need a room of our own.
So what do we lose without religion, and how does religion relate to the soul?
Well, religion, that's a really good question. It's not easy to discuss this, but I think what it does is that religion, it has to do with meaning, with finding purpose in life and making sense of the world in which we live, and especially making sense of our mortality, the fact that we don't live forever. So when sickness comes along, a lot of people find religion. You know, I've written about sickness, too, in medicine, and I've talked to a lot of people in hospitals who say that the advantage, the gift of getting sick, was that they began to realize what really matters. They found their own religion through sickness. So that's a way of finding your soul. Religion takes us deep enough, and when you get to those deep thoughts and feelings, you're in the realm of soul.
Aren't some religions, though, actually getting more intense? I'm thinking of fundamental Christian people and Muslims who can be very fanatical.
Well, fanatical is another kind of intensity. It's not the kind I'm talking about or promoting, certainly. I think that kind of fanaticism, you know, speaking now as a therapist, I would say that's it's kind of an acting out. It's coming out of deep impulses that, you know, that don't really have much, aren't rooted in one's thought, and, you know, and they can be destructive. So that's, we don't want that. That's a symptom of what we need. It's a symptomatic form of what we need. What we really need is an intensity about looking at the world honestly and openly and finding solutions that work for us so that we are comforted and calm and at peace with ourselves so that we don't become fanatics.
If you'd like to join in the conversation with Dr. Thomas Moore, you can call us at 1-800-743-9576. That's 1-800-743-9576, or you can email us at radio@wlrn.org. How important is a belief in a God or a supreme being, or is it only this soul connection that we need?
Well, the belief in a God is so different for each person. I tend to really follow the mystics of all the different religions. The mystics are those people that have really brought their religion home to them as individuals and have had these very profound experiences through meditation and that sort of thing. And what they all teach, I mean, across the religions, what they teach is that God or divinity, God is that which we encounter when we come to the very edge of our existence and when we say, well, what's going on, and deal with the mysteries around us. You know, what's the meaning of it all, and what's my life all about in the first place? When you face those mysteries and really sense that, really, really feel it, you may not be able to find language for it, because it's the closer you get to those deep mysteries, the more difficult it is to talk about them. So the mystics say, let's not use the word God, because that's kind of a tool, an instrument, if you don't get too far into it. Well, I'm suggesting that maybe we should be cautious of our use of the name God now. It's been used too easily to really get in the way of religious experience. So but at the same time, my book's all about God, even though I don't use the name God at all.
Tell me, Thomas Moore, you're talking about in the book about that we should be more serene and thoughtful, but in today's hectic world, I'm thinking, say, an overburdened single parent with two jobs, it's difficult for them to be so zen-like.
Well, I don't know. I'm a father as well, gone through it, and I'm overworked and doing too many jobs at once. And what I've found is that a little bit goes a long way. So I don't expect myself to become, you know, a sort of professional mystic who just is contemplating the universe all the time. But I do find that if I can go for a walk in the woods now and then, you know, take a half hour. I used to go with my dog. Fortunately, my dog died recently, but he was a very good Zen master for me. You know, he would take me out into the world, and I couldn't say no to him. I had to take him out or suffer the consequences, you know. So he would take me out, and I would be there in nature, and that was contemplative. I believe strongly in a kind of meditation that's in the world and not outside of it.
So, I'm sorry.
And so that's what I would do. You know, that was my form of meditation.
And you chose to model this book after Henry David Thoreau. Is that why?
That's part of it. Yeah, I learned so much from Thoreau and Emerson, Emily Dickinson, the New England Transcendentalists, because they were in the same boat that we are today, I think. They were finding that institutional religion has some limitations, but they didn't want to give up on it. They wanted to find something that they could practice for themselves. Thoreau was so interesting because he says that getting up early in the morning was a sacrament for him. I mean, just getting up early. You didn't have to do anything. It was like being a monk to get up early in the morning. Or to take a bath for him was a kind of little baptism. So I think he has a great insight there that we have made religion too precious. You know, it's got to be all these very special ceremonies done in certain times. But he was saying that there's something about everyday life that is also sacred if you have the eye for it. And so, yes, he's a very big influence on this book.
We're speaking with Dr. Thomas Moore. There's an echo in here.
Yes.
He's a religion scholar. His latest book is A Religion of One's Own. We're going to take a short break and be back with more.
And welcome back to Monday's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Dr. Thomas Moore. He's an author, religion scholar, and his latest book is A Religion of One's Own, A Guide to Creating a Personal Spirituality in a Secular World. You say we shouldn't separate the spiritual from the psychological. What do you mean by that?
Well, this is difficult for some people, I guess, to grasp, because we often think of the spiritual and the soulful as the same thing. But it's a very old tradition, I mean ancient, that there's a difference between the soul and the spirit. The soul, we talk about soul carefully. It refers to everything that's very deep in us, our deep emotions and our deep memories, our connections, deep connections to home, to places, you know, to people, to animals, whatever. To be a soulful person is to be someone who's really alive. And when you meet a soulful person, I think you say, well, here's a real person, you know, a real individual. They're unique, and you can connect up with them, and they have a sense of humor. They're really, really alive. A spiritual person, and spirit is different. It has to do with reaching beyond our humanness. And that's also important, to have great vision, to think about what the world's all about and what the universe is and what the future might have in store for us and what afterlife might be. All of these very big questions that transcend us as human beings. So important to have that too. So to be spiritual and psychological at the same time is really important, but they are two different things.
Let's take a telephone call or two. We've got Francis in Weston. Hi there.
Hi, Dr. Moore, I totally agree with everything that you're saying. I see this in my own practice as a therapist, and as a result, I developed a app for the, you know, phone and computer so that clients can actually track their soulful activity. Like you were mentioning, just taking a walk in the park or spending some time with your animal, so that people can really see that they are on the path to soulfulness and participating in a soul-filled life. One of the things I see a lot with my own clients is if they have like a relapse. They're like scared of religion or intimidated by going to a church or a temple. So this particular app allows them to see the progress that they've made day by day. So I think incorporating technology in this particular app, it's called the Soul Tracker, allows us to really track the soulful activities and see that there's meaning in the little things.
Well, thank you, Frances. You know, that reminds me, I lived the life of a monk when I was young, and one of the things we did every day, part of our monk's practice, was to take a look at the day's activities, you know, to examine the day, and to have that daily practice to see what's going on in very simple ways. When I talk about these things today, some people think it's just too simple, you know, but actually we overlook those simple elements, and it sounds very good to me to help people in that way, to be able to look at their daily life. I think a lot of people think that psychology and therapy is about figuring themselves out, so it's a very mental activity. But if we can make it more concrete and keep it going so it's a daily practice, just like the monks, I think we'd be much better off.
Absolutely. And this particular tool that I created is just so that people can see on paper or on the screen that they are walking in that direction. And in those small things, whether it's eating something healthy or connecting with earth or with an animal or meditating, really is that connection that you're talking about, both spiritually and psychologically. Thank you very much. I'm going to pick up your book.
Thank you.
Okay,
thanks.
And we'll move along to another caller. This is Joe in Weston. Hi there.
Hello, everyone. This is a fascinating conversation, and it really touched off a personal note in me, even down to the references of Walden Pond and all that stuff. I mean, I grew up in a very strict religious Jewish house and had trouble sitting through 4 hours of ritualized synagogue services on a Saturday afternoon and used to walk out the back door and wander around the woods and the lake in the back of the synagogue. And as my journey away from the fold continued and delved more into philosophy and literature, and I discovered the books of William James and Cosmin Sakis and Herman Hesse, authors I'm sure you're very familiar with, I really learned to see that you have to be able to separate the leaves from the trees. And I guess my biggest complaint with religion, if I boil it all down to anything, is when you have people that are excellent at practicing ritual, but still not humble and still not feeling like these are people who have God in their hearts. And that's, I guess, what I've learned in my own path towards enlightenment, that religion and the belief in God really is all about, is that you as a person are not king of the world, you're not the wolf of Wall Street, and everything isn't about you. And if there's one thing that believing in a higher power does, whether this higher power even exists or not, is it takes away a lot of this, it's all about me, everything is for me, taking everything I can find in the world and making it something to give me pleasure. This is something that I've really found that I think all the true religions talk about in their texts, but a lot of the practice of the business of religion today has really drifted away from that.
And Thomas More?
Yes, it's wonderful what you're saying. It helps helps us see that having a religion of your own can be very individual from one person to another. And the language used may be very different. One of the things I noticed when you talk about a higher power, see, from my point of view, I'd probably talk about a deeper power, because just to take a look at religion as something that goes deep and it has a lot of soul in it, that's what I would emphasize. But, you know, some people will find what we're talking about within the religion they were brought up in, like if it's Jewish or Christian or Muslim, whatever. And others will find it by piecing together something for themselves, more like Thoreau. And I think both are valid. We tend to judge things too much these days. And if we could allow this variety of experience and listen closely to the language people are using, we'd find that to be religious is something that is quite individual and can even change quite a bit within a person's lifetime.
Go ahead.
Don't you think some people feel that they're betraying their traditions, though, if they look elsewhere for answers?
Yes, well, I think you're right, absolutely. People do worry about that and feel it. I don't feel any of that, but I understand it. I appreciate that people do. I think that's the change that has to take place, that we have to realize now that the religious traditions of the world are there for us all. And it's been a mistake to make it so much a matter of membership and that one is at odds with another. In fact, one is inimical to the other. Mm-hmm. I think it's time to realize that the religious traditions are there for us all, and that the fact that there are so many different ones enriches our experience. And so it requires a shift in our attitude. And I hope that we can do that, because this competition among the religions has just hurt everybody.
We have a caller who wants to know, Thomas Moore, of your feelings about religious certitude, that a particular faith is the way only.
Well, that's...
Yes. Well, the certitude has got to come, I would say, from yourself. You know, and certitude in that saying, I'm right and you're wrong, it's about the depth of understanding. It's that kind of insight. I much prefer moving for insight rather than the feeling that my certitude means that I'm right. I wish we could get rid of that. It's been part of religion for a long time, has given rise to what I was saying, to judgments about people, even to something like an Inquisition where people were tortured because they didn't believe what they were supposed to believe. And I think we just need to go so much farther away from that, but not away from certitude, but a kind of certitude that's rooted in your openness to your own experience, to using your mind and your intellect freely for yourself, to being an adult and using your intelligence to put it all together so that you feel the certitude that has some risk in it and some constant questioning. You can always go deeper with it. But it's not the certitude that now I'm going to attach myself to a system that must be right.
Do you consider yourself a Christian, and do you still follow the Bible?
Oh, yes. I just translated the Gospels from Greek not long ago.
I guess that's following the Bible.
That's following it very closely, but I think we need to be more intelligent. That's my big word, intelligent, and go deeper into it. Yes, I consider myself Christian. I will never not be Catholic. I tell you, when you're born into the Catholic Church, you never get rid of it. It's there in your bones. And I think that's a good thing, but it does change, too, over time, and I've changed immensely. I've written a couple of articles where I call myself a Zen Catholic. And by that I mean that I'm Catholic, but I've been so influenced by other religions, especially Zen Buddhism, that that has colored it and changed it.
You lecture widely on spirituality, and we're talking a lot about religion. Do you consider yourself religious or spiritual, or do you differentiate between them?
Well, you know, when I was a monk, if I can go back to that again, I was very religious. In fact, I was called a religious. I was a very religious person. I wore a habit. I had a rosary hanging from my belt. I really looked religious too. We had what we call the spiritual life had to do with our intense inner life, like our meditation and prayer. That was where our spirituality came in. So it was part of our religious experience. So that's how I still think of it. I don't make this distinction between being spiritual and being religious. When I talk about religion, now, the reason I call this book A Religion of One's Own and not A Spirituality of One's Own is that I wanted to link it up with what religion has meant in the past, but revising it, reimagining what religion is, but keeping that sense of practice, of loyalty, of tradition. And so it's not just something we make up for ourselves and not just an individual experience, where we can share it with people around the world. And our sense of community might also deepen and expand.
I found it interesting that you talk about arts and religion as closely related, and that you can use arts as a gateway to understanding religious issues. How does one do that?
When I was studying religion at Syracuse University, doing my doctoral studies there, it was a wonderful program, and one of the reasons was that we could study ordinary literature, what we would call secular literature, but explore the questions, the same issues that religion brings up. So we put the religious traditions and secular literature together into one big bag. I found that to be really, really helpful and interesting. And so I just expand that. If you look at art history, you're going to a museum, you'll find that so many of the great paintings are related to religion. The great Buddhas, you know, the great Buddhas are wonderful. Paintings and sculptures of the Buddha. Imagine, can you separate the art from the religion there? I don't think so. Or the great annunciations in Christianity and the paintings that you have all over the world. You can't separate the devotion to a religious mystery from the art. Well, I think we can just apply that to our own experience then and realize that all the arts are great opportunities for us to go deeper into our experience, so deep that we touch on these religious mysteries.
Dr. Thomas Moore, you say in your book that we need to live ethically. Obviously, that's a good choice. But you say that one should leave an unethical work situation. But for some people, that's easier said than done.
Oh, it's really tough. I think that to be a really ethical, moral person is very, very difficult and very subtle. Now, religions, the established religions, often make it too simple. They try to say this is right and that's wrong. I think for the person who has an individual religious sensibility, it's going to be very tough to make decisions that are moral all day long. There are so many pros and cons and subtleties in every moral decision. That's true about work. So if you know that the company you're working for is doing a lot of unethical things, you have to decide how much can you tolerate or what can you do, or is it better to stay in this company and try to work for some change, or is it necessary to leave in order to be honest with yourself? So these are very tough questions, but I think we have to pursue them, and that is really what makes us more of a religious person.
One of the things you said, how understanding and cultivating waiting is a spiritual skill and can allow us to hear the voice of our creative muse. I think most of us, you know, especially in today's world, we do a lot of waiting. So how can we use that time better?
Oh, I feel this every day. I mean, I just flew across the country yesterday. I had to wait in that airplane, wait to arrive, you know, for 7 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Or are you waiting at the doctor's office or the dentist's office? What I do is I avoid the magazines because usually they're a little outdated. They're not too interesting anyway. I avoid the magazines and I sit because I learned from Zen Buddhism that sitting is what you do when you meditate. You sit. It doesn't mean that you do anything else. You don't try to, you know, do anything fancy with your mind. You just sit. And so I go in those places and sit and calm myself and let thoughts come to mind and images to the point where I go deeper and deeper into it. And sometimes they have to kind of shake me to tell me it's time to go in and see the doctor, you know, because that's the meditation. To me, that's one of the best times to meditate, when you are forced in this modern life to wait.
Even if you're next to someone using their cell phone incessantly.
Oh, yeah. If you can really sit carefully, you know, really do it, you don't notice the cell phone after a while.
I didn't understand this. You said you suggest practicing self-therapy by writing out our own personal myth and studying our fears and longings. What do you mean?
Oh, yeah.
What do you mean by writing out our own personal myth?
You know, each question you're asking is a book. Do you know that?
Well,
we only have a couple of minutes.
This question, the personal myth, what I mean by that is that I also suggest looking at your dream life. All of my work as a therapist is based on dreams. We have,
really?
You know, we each have a very, very deep stratum within us. Deep, deep, you know, repeated themes. You don't see them until you really look closely at your dreams. And you find that you don't just have your surface biography. You've got things going on deep inside you today that were going on when you were a child, that were going on when you were a younger person. And these things are being lived over like cycles over and over again. And if you can name that, if you can catch some of those themes that are going on, that is your myth. That's the deep mythology that you're living. And if you can get closer to that, you know yourself better, I think you can avoid some of the problems that normally you'd run into.
Could you give us an example? Are you talking about if you were afraid as a child of loss or afraid of abandonment? Okay, so how did...
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
I grew up with a lot of fears. Myself, for example, great fear of water. I was in a boating accident when I was 4 years old. Well, that's part of my myth. Whenever I get near water now, you know, I have a hard time. Swimming, people always throw life preservers at me, you know, because they think, I think I'm swimming and they think I'm drowning. You know, it's not easy to have this as part of your myth. That's a very concrete thing. But it has to do with other anxieties about taking risks. You know, I feel that in myself, and I know that's my myth. And knowing it, I don't have to judge myself so much. I just have to deal with it time after time. It's part of my deep story.
Well, we only have about a minute left. There's so much more to talk about. But you talk about breaking through also as being so important. Well, we only have 30 seconds left. Okay, doctor, can you talk about that?
Well, yes, that's like transcending. Part of this idea of being religious is to transcend, get beyond yourself where you've been in any way, you know, travel, try things out, take risks. Any kind of transcendence is part of your religion.
Well, Dr. Thomas Moore, best-selling author. He was a monk for 12 years, a university professor, a psychotherapist. Today he lectures widely on holistic medicine and spirituality.
And we'll have links at our Facebook page and also the WLRN.org.
And your website is careofthesoul.net.
That's right.
And this book is A Religion of One's Own, A Guide to Creating a Personal Spirituality in a Secular World. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Maya Angelou next.
And welcome back to Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman with you. The beloved Dr. Maya Angelou joins us now. She's considered one of the most renowned and influential voices of our time, a civil rights activist, a distinguished professor, an award-winning poet and author. She's won the Literarian Award and a Grammy, among many others. She's won the Presidential Medal of Freedom and holds 30 honorary degrees. Dr. Angelou joins us from her home in North Carolina. Welcome, doctor, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so very much.
It's truly our great privilege to have you with us today.
Well, I know you also have the great privilege of having weather in the 70s or 80s.
That we do.
That's good for you.
Well, doctor, here we are 50 years after Dr. King's March on Washington. How do you feel that we've progressed as a nation?
Ms. Berman, you know, progress is a gradual thing. It's like evolution. We are evolving. We are becoming better. It's just that we live such short and brief and scattered lives like a scat jazz singer. But so we don't get to see as much change. It's so gradual. But, you know, if you think back, since I've been alive, it was possible to lynch a black man on the street corner and not do a day for it. You understand?
Yes, of course.
You have to look at, especially when you grow older, you have to look at the gradual changes and be grateful for them so that you can work still to make more change.
So you'll be sharing your thoughts about race relations this Thursday evening at Congregation B'nai Israel in Boca Raton.
Well, a little of that. I might decide to speak about the art of bicycle riding.
Okay, well, we can do that too.
Making a good apple pie.
How would you, though, describe the current state of civil rights and race relations in American society and worldwide, for that matter?
Ms. Berman, it's still iffy. It's still, there's hate is so, in so many hearts. They're just hate because the parents, a woman told me, my daddy never liked you people. But what had I done to her that she would say that to me in a public place? Just because she was white and I was black. So, no, there's a lot of ignorance. It's still, people can be afraid of those things and folks they don't understand. So I'm sorry to say that it's not as good as it will be in 10 years. It'll be better in 10 years. Even 10 years ago, would you believe we'd have had a black president?
No.
So here we are. We are getting better. Just better and better. We're growing up a bit. Okay.
Would you tell us what it was like working with the two men and friends with the two men who shaped history and race relations in the world, Dr. King and Nelson Mandela? How did that influence your life?
And Malcolm X. Mm-hmm. I learned so much. With Mr. Mandela, I met him when I lived in Egypt. I was a journalist. And he came because he was head of the ANC, the African National Congress. All of his people were there, and the other group, which was a rival organization, my husband was head of that.
And what was that?
That was a PAC, Pan-African Congress. It was a little more more of an activist organization than the ANC. And so I had heard them, the men, arguing at the tops of their voices just since I'd been in Egypt, since I'd met the South Africans, my husband's friends. But when Mr. Mandela came, he never raised his voice. Never. And you know he felt as committed to his side as the others did.
Mm-hmm.
I just saw that kindness. I also noted that that Mr. Mandela would actually compliment my cook on her shoes or on her apron. That's not usual. But he made everybody feel at ease. That was blacks, whites, Boers, Afrikaans, Xhosa, Zulu. Just wonderful.
It sounds like he also made everybody feel important.
That's right. Now, do you have that poem, the Mandela tribute?
Not in front of me, I don't know.
Oh, no, I'm just wondered if you had it, if you were going to. I just wondered, had you read it?
Oh, I definitely read it.
Oh, thank you.
You know, speaking of your writing, in your book, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, you write of your childhood in Stamps, Arkansas, and the values instilled in you by your grandma. How did your childhood shape this journey of yours? Can you tell us?
You're not asking me that question. You can ask me, but then do you have 2 or 3 hours where we just...
Well, let me ask you this then. Can you describe at all for us what it is about you that provides you with this ability to influence the world on such a monumental scale, which you do, for all generations?
Well, I'm aware that I have been so blessed. I'm aware that I've been brought from the muck and the mire to stand with kings and queens and presidents. Yes, I have been brought. So I'm grateful. I continue to have an attitude of gratitude. So when people come up, I know that if I'm with human beings, I'll be all right. Even the bad ones, I'll be all right. I don't know what it would be like to be in a company of zebras or fleas or something, but I know a human being. And there's a statement by Terence. He says, "Homo sum." I am a human being. Nothing human can be alien to me. And when you look in the encyclopedia for Terence with one R, you see that line in Latin, and this and the number of date, the date rather, is Terence was an African. He was in the italics, it says Terentius Afer. He was an African, freed by that senator who owned him, and he became the most popular playwright in Rome. that statement have come, five plays have come to us from 154 B.C. So I have no argument with everybody. Bitterness is dangerous. It's like cancer. It eats upon the host. So I don't have that. I can be angry at a cruelty to anybody, but I'm not going to spend any of my time being bitter.
No, it sounds like your heart is filled with love.
Thank you.
I was thinking your career has spanned so many passions, so many years, so many different domains. You've given so much of yourself. What would you like to still accomplish?
Oh, I'd like more love in the world, more courage to love each other. Not. I don't mean a lot of sentimentality and romance, and I don't mean that. I meant real love. I'd like to see it.
Tell us more. Tell us more about real love. What does that look like? What would that look like to you?
Well, it would mean that when we see a child who is hungry, if the child looks like us, we give him some food. But if he doesn't, we give him some food. And we try to find out, does he have shoes? And the fact that he speaks a different language or eats food prepared differently should not make a bit of difference to me when I see a child. There's a song, I've just been writing it with Valerie Simpson. Valerie and her husband were the couple who wrote almost everything. Ain't no mountain high enough, and reach out and touch somebody's hand. I have so many of those. I saw two young people sitting on the street in London, and a man passed by them and spat on them. These are two young white people, probably about, maybe 20 years old. The man who spat on them looked more like them than they looked like me, but I knew that was the wrong, you shouldn't, this is somebody's children. And if nobody's there to claim them, I claim them. So I'm not a cursing person, but I went to that man and I caught him by his jacket and I just used my finger and poked him in the chest. Now, I don't curse, so so I made got him. I said, you knock-kneed, slew-footed Texas, southern-eaten, southern. I don't know what I said.
Well, you got his attention.
I did, and the children got there. And backpacks and their little dog and their guitars and continued walking down the street. So I never knew if they were Welsh or Swedish or could have been Russian. I don't know. But I wrote a song. So the lyric is, when you see him on the highway hitching rides with his dogs and his guitar by his side, you need to ask, what's all the lying and the dying, and the killing, and the thrilling all about? Take time out. When you see him with a band around his head, and an army surplus bunk that makes his bed, you need to ask, what's all the bleeding, and the kneading, and the beating, and the cheating all about? Take time out. Now you can sell your soul for money, then run off to the country, for your cookouts and your parties on the lawns. While our children seek sedation in Eastern meditation or visions that go shooting up their arms. Feel some sorrow for the folks who thought tomorrow was a place that they could call up on the phone. Take a month and show some kindness for the folks who thought that blindness was an illness that affected eyes alone. Well, anyway, I finished the poem, and Miss Simpson is writing the music, and I'm longing for it.
I feel so privileged to have been able to hear that.
Thank you.
Dr. Maya Angelou, thank you so much for spending your time with us today. It's been an honor, and we wish you all continued success and the very, very best, and I hope to see you next Thursday.
Thank you. Please come back. Make it a And I hope to come and see me.
Okay.
Take hands.
Please take care.
And thank you in the same. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Dr. Angelou will speak on race relations at Congregation B'nai Israel on Yamato Road in Boca Raton this Thursday at 7:30 p.m. as part of their speaker series. The evening commemorates the 50th anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King's March on Washington. It also commemorates the 30th anniversary of an interfaith relationship between Congregation B'nai Israel and Ebenezer Missionary Baptist Church of Boca Raton. More information on the event is available at cbiboca.org. That's cbiboca.org. And 561-241-8118. That's 561-241-8118. And we'll have links on our website at WLRN.org and on our Facebook page at facebook.com/topicalcurrents. Thank you so much for joining us.
And that's today's Topical Currents. Our producer is Richard Ives. Technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. We have free audio archives and downloads at our website. That's WLRN.org. More information and links at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's program examines how adversity makes us more resilient and even more creative. We'll visit with Georgetown University psychiatrist Norman Rosenthal, author of The Gift of Adversity. And to the calendar on this day in 1863, 151 years ago, England's Thomas Crapper pioneers the one-piece pedestal flushing toilet. He wasn't the inventor, but greatly enhanced its efficiency. For that, we're grateful. And on this day in 1962, 52 years ago, the death of TV pioneer Ernie Kovacs in a Los Angeles auto accident. He once presented an all-gorilla presentation of Swan Lake and a poker game set to Beethoven's Fifth. Then there was an all-pantomime program called The Silent Show. And one more while we let that lonesome whistle blow my blues away. On this day in 1968, 45 years ago, Johnny Cash makes his legendary Folsom Prison appearance with June Carter, Carl Perkins, and the Statler Brothers. That prison cafeteria recording is considered one of the greatest of all time. Theme music composed by Michael Levine. So we leave with an oft-quoted thought from Ernie Kovacs. Television, a medium, so called because it's neither rare nor well done. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned. Up next is Here and Now from NPR News.